Hi, this is Roger Green, executive producer and host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This weekend, we are bringing you six conversations from episode six, our Friday conversation with global KOLs about the impact of the Rezdiffra approval on Thursday. This conversation focuses on the impact of having a drug on getting patients to comply with lifestyle interventions. Sober Yanasi notes the historical difficulty of getting patients to comply in this way and believes that by adding a drug to the discussion, it makes the lifestyle modification easier to explain to patients and easier to get them to follow. Jeff McIntyre points out specifically that it will deal with the issue of stigma, that when you say to a patient simply lose pounds and exercise more, they feel like they're being chided. But if you can put this in the context of a medication and a total regimen, they might accept it more readily. I note that in my 25 years of marketing research, one thing I learned was that physicians felt a certain amount of contempt for patients who could not comply with lifestyle, particularly folks in the metabolic category who tended to be obese, bad diets, too much drinking, etc. The approval of a first drug indicated for MASH may be the most significant achievement in fatty liver disease in longer than anyone can remember, certainly since some of the major diagnostic decisions and assessments were made. The conversation is interesting, and our global leaders have a variety of perspectives, so sit back, listen, enjoy, learn, and when you're done, join the conversation in our LinkedIn discussion group.
Zober Yanasi.
I actually think that, you know, historically we've had issues with lifestyle intervention just because it was very difficult to, people are not used to think about lifestyle as a prescription. The same way you're prescribing a statin to someone, telling somebody you're going to go lose 10 pounds and come back in 6 months, that means absolutely nothing. So it may actually, this will, could prompt the practitioners to now say that, well, this is a regimen, and that regimen should be done with these things, and then bring in the type of other successful opportunities for folks in terms of nutrition, exercise, and other programs that then can be connected to the drug and make it much more effective. And I think when you have a pill and then you can say, well, this is not something that you're going to just, now that you have an injection, you can just inject yourself and forget about what you eat. This is the same way. You're not just going to take the pill and just forget about everything else. So it will give us an opportunity to enhance that message, that that message of lifestyle intervention is as important now and probably more important now than before, because you've got something, I don't have a lot of data for this at the moment, that I would suspect that the efficacy of this regimen would be even better if you can effectively implement lifestyle. I think those are the messages that can be now packaged to patients in much more logical way that patients may understand now that there's a disease and as a drug, but also as another piece to it that needs to be worked on.
Jörn Schattenberg.
I agree, Zober. Two quick comments, Roger, before I get back to you. I think, you know, lifestyle and dietary education was part of the phase 3 trial. I agree, across different continents, it's probably very diverse how this was enforced. The label, the way it reads, is actually very similar to the other U.S. labels, as far as I'm aware. For example, in the GLP-1, it says this is indicated as an adjunct to diet and exercise to improve glycemic control in adults with type 2 diabetes, is what it reads on the GLP-1 label. So I think for metabolic drugs, this is the typical wording the FDA uses to highlight that there's an underlying need for lifestyle and exercise.
And I completely agree. I think that's in the label, and I think there should have been a label. But on the other hand, it's always difficult to make it reality in the practice. And I think that's what, you know, sort of, coming to some consensus with different guidance that we have, that we now have to provide the providers and the patients with tools that they can use. I mean, right now it's US only, but in the future, but even in the US, not everybody eats the same kind of food. If you can't tell somebody in some part of the country in the United States to just go eat Mediterranean food, that's not culturally sensitive or appropriate. I think what we need to do is to understand what that means and actually make it so that those folks understand how to actually eat the diet that they've been eating, but eat it healthy. And what does healthy mean with different types of recipes and diets from different sort of backgrounds, and what does activity mean? And as you know, Jörn is a part of the Global NASH Council, and we're putting in big effort to sort of develop both provider and patient material that then can be used in terms of what is the right lifestyle modification that is geographically appropriate, culturally appropriate, and then also can be applied. And that's the guideline that's being actually put together. And for lifestyle, Shiraz Zarvasagi is the one who's leading from the Global NASH Council, that effort. And that should be available by summer of this year.
Roger Green.
So before I kick this over to Jeff, I have one brief comment from 25 years of marketing research, which is that community physicians, virtually regardless of whether they're primary care or specialty, when given diet and exercise as their only tool, basically say they've got nothing. But if you give them a drug so that it's diet and exercise literally as an adjunct to medication, flip the script on this. It's not the medication is the adjunct. The medication is what drives the behavior. Diet and exercise are an adjunct. I'm where Zobair was a minute ago, which is at that point, I think people take it a lot more seriously. And I think we'll see a much greater effort, particularly among community physicians who've got less time to treat and may have a less powerful motivation to think about steatotic liver disease all day, to actually bring diet and exercise to those conversations a lot more aggressively. And I believe that's part of the benefit that we'll get from this.
Jeff McIntyre.
Roger, frankly, you just about made my point in this, which was that what I anticipate in this, and I think what you're saying as well, is that this will also be helpful in terms of reducing stigma. Because when you are given, from a patient perspective, if you're given a prescription of lose 10 pounds, just diet and exercise, there is a big sort of, well, if you just have the willpower, you know, you need to go do right and lose some weight on this. But once you're able to add a medication into the recipe of what is coming from your provider on this, then it suddenly kind of medicalizes the behavior and the lifestyle changes that need to happen. And that's really, really significant. It takes it away from like, well, this is just willpower and I'm a bad human being, to suddenly a treatment regimen that the provider is somebody that the patient can then go to or look for other experts to be able to seek support from. And that's going to be something that's really significant going forward with this.
Just to follow up with what Jeff said, we have this stigma, the original stigma paper in Journal of Hepatology a couple of months ago, but in the past few days, we have the impact of stigma and liver disease burden on quality of life. But when you look at liver disease burden, patient with fatty liver disease, self-blame is a major part of actually the package they carry with themselves. So I think it's going to be really important in that context. In the United States, I have to say that, yes, gastroenterologists will be prescribing, and they should be the target of education so that they can actually understand the importance of the drug and how to use it, when not to use it, and how to, you know, all those things that's going to be important. But in the United States, it's the target audience will be our advanced practitioners. Advanced practitioners in the United States treat patients with, you know, early liver disease, at least. So, and even, you know, by early liver disease, I mean even F3s. They're engaged with patients with cirrhosis and advanced cirrhosis and liver transplantation. But I think those are the folks that need to be engaged. And thank God, actually, they were probably a lot easier to bring, not only the medication side, but the lifestyle intervention side. They are the ones who could connect with the nutrition, with behavioral health, with exercise specialists, those kind of things that are not always available in any system, but at least there may be a few things available that they can actually utilize to bring folks together. So I'm very enthusiastic to support the gastroenterology for the U.S., gastroenterology and the APPs, to make sure they are aware of the regimen and the lifestyle intervention that will go with it.
So let me step back for a second and welcome our friend Laurent Castera, who has been able to arrive and get himself connected. Laurent, how are you this evening?
Laurent Castera.
How are you? First of all, I would like to apologize for being late, but my train arrived late. So, and I'm very happy to be there and to see many familiar faces.
And a bit of a celebration, eh, Laurent?
Absolutely. Incredible news. I don't want to repeat because I'm sure you already commented, so I'm trying to catch up.
I guess the question we're kind of on right now is how this will be integrated into treatment. You know, obviously in the U.S. where we can use it now, it'll be a little bit different. But what do you foresee? What were the challenges, the patient types that you're thinking about right now today on the other side of the approval?
Of course, I mean, we're going to have time to give some thought about it because it won't come to Europe before a while. My take is that first, I think it's a very good news for patients, because this has been long awaited, and of course it's going to change the field. I think also this is good news even for the patient that we won't be able to treat for the time being in Europe, because this is going to bring a lot of attention on MASLD and the fact that there will be a treatment, because this is usually what GPs say, you know, when you discuss with them, they say, yeah, okay, you know, it's not very high on my agenda because I'm looking for the diabetes, I'm looking for hypertension, I'm looking for obesity, and liver is really low on my agenda. And why should I screen this disease? Because there is no treatment. So at least now there's a treatment, and I think we can use it as a leverage to increase the awareness of MASLD outside of the liver field. And I think this is very important. The second point is that it seems that the label comes without a liver biopsy. So this is a major shift. I mean, of course, as experts, we've been prepared. But again, outside, let's say beyond the liver field, I think it's going to be a very important message to convey that we do not stick anymore to liver biopsy and that we might use non-invasive tests to select patients.
So as you joined a couple of minutes ago, Jorn asked Ian a question that Ian never got around to having an opportunity to answer because we've jumped in.
I put him on the spot. He doesn't have to answer because it's a tough one.
No, but this is Ian. He usually has an answer. If you don't have an answer, Ian, it's fine.
Ian Rowe.
I've got an answer. I mean, the answer is that I don't really know. But I mean, I think Lauren's arrived at the perfect moment, though, because we were talking about how you can use non-invasive tests to confidently identify people who've got F2 or F3, but exclude patients who've got cirrhosis. Because as Zubair said, you know, there are concerns about not using the medicine off-label in people who've got more advanced disease so that we don't either encounter unanticipated hepatotoxicity and cause a threat to continued use of the drug. So first thing that I did yesterday was to dive into some of our local data of patients who've been biopsied who've got Fib4, ELF and FibroScan to try and look at what the probability of significant or advanced fibrosis that isn't cirrhosis would be present in those patients. And actually, it looks like it's as difficult as I thought, which is really quite difficult.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page in which you downloaded this conversation or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. We'll be back Wednesday night with a group of patient advocates discussing their excitement, reaction, and next steps after the approval of Rezdiffra. Until then, stay safe, surf on. We'll see you on the podcast. Bye-bye now.